Welcome to the July podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pincham. The July issue is on the topic of Rathke's cleft cyst. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Nelson Oyesiku of Emory University, Atlanta, Georgia, speaks with Dr. Zada of the University of Southern California, Los Angeles. They discuss Dr. Zada's article, Rathke Cleft Cysts, A Review of Clinical and Surgical Management, which appears in this month's issue.
Well, good afternoon, Dr. Zada, and good afternoon to our listeners. Welcome to the podcast, which is based on the Neurosurgical Focus July issue, which centers on Rathke's cleft cyst. Dr. Zada is from the University of Southern California, and I serve as one of two guest editors for this issue. My name is Nelson Oshiku from Emory University, and my joint guest editor is Dr. Cal Post from New York. So, Dr. Zada, I enjoyed your article, which was a comprehensive review of both the clinical presentation, the imaging, pathology, as well as strategies for operative as well as non-operative management in patients with Rathke's cleft cyst.
Thank you so much, Dr. Oshiku.
Yes, indeed. As you rightly pointed out, there's actually a spectrum of these cysts that occur in the stellar and paracellar region, and we're seeing them more and more in clinical practice, as you know, because obviously imaging is becoming more robust and is used more frequently in clinical practice. And so there's a large number of these cases that we now see in pituitary clinics all over the country where patients just come to attention for what for all the world sounds like incidental symptoms. Many people would like to know, including myself, I'd be interested in your views on how you deal with this. Is the patient who comes in having had a Rathke's cleft cyst discovered for what appears to be incidental symptoms that are not that doesn't appear to be directly related, or maybe perhaps if you stretched the picture a little bit, they might. How do you sort that out in terms of the clinical picture?
Yeah, so the Rathke cleft cysts are. There was a really nice study done by Teramoto where he looked at autopsy specimens, and he found that these cysts are, in fact, the most common incidentally found lesion of the pituitary gland and cellar region, even more than microadenomas. And he found that in over 20% of patients. So, as you mentioned, we're seeing it more and more in patients who have MRIs and occasionally CT scans done for a whole host of other reasons. And so deciding how to manage patients who present with incidental Rathke's cleft cysts is going to become increasingly important. I think the first thing is obviously to note whether patients have symptoms. And the majority of these are asymptomatic lesions. The smaller Rathke's cleft cysts that are less than a centimeter in patients that are asymptomatic, it's very hard to justify doing anything other than just monitoring those patients clinically, occasionally ordering a follow-up imaging scan a year later to ensure that there's no growth of the cyst. But in very small cysts in patients that are asymptomatic, that may not even be warranted. And occasionally you'll find a patient who is symptomatic. And in those cases, you'll have more justification for offering any kind of intervention. Now, there's an intermediate between that where patients may have very subtle symptoms or subtle findings that have not been very obvious. And so in larger cysts, frequently measuring over 1 centimeter, they may have subtle visual field deficits, for instance. And so in a Rathke's cleft cyst that is either isolated to the suprasellar area or combined intracellular and suprasellar, a formal visual field exam may be warranted to make sure there's no subclinical visual field deficits. And routine ordering of endocrine labs may also be worthwhile to make sure that there's no evidence of hypopituitarism. And when you're talking to patients, it's very important to consider a lot of the endocrine findings, doing a very thorough history about, for instance, menstrual history, evidence of hypocortisolemia, or elevated prolactin level, things like that. And so it's very gender and age specific as well, but that's kind of how I view it, is in those separate categories.
And so have you found in your clinical investigations any commonality in terms of pituitary hormonal profile? Are they more likely to be hypopit? Are they more likely to be hyperprolactinemic or hypothyroid or hypergonad? Or does it vary considerably such that there's not a uniformity in terms of hormonal profiling?
There's not always a uniformity, but looking back at the literature, the most common types of endocrinopathy associated with these cysts are hyperprolactinemia. And it's always important, obviously, that the level that needs to be separated from something like pituitary stalk effect. And so we usually use a cutoff of 200 for the prolactin level, and most Rathke-Clef cysts will never exceed that value. And it's also important to remember when you're looking at a cystic lesion, the differential diagnosis should be broad, and something like a cystic tumor or cystic prolactinoma or craniopharyngioma is always in the diagnosis. And so teasing out those very subtle types of endocrine deficiencies is very important. But hyperprolactinemia is one of the most common, and also a low growth hormone level has also been associated. Beyond that, things like hypocortisolemia, hypothyroidism, hypogonadism are less likely, but still can be seen, especially in recurrent cysts or in atypical Rathke-Clef cysts, as I call them. And those happen to be the ones that are highly inflamed with thickened walls. And, you know, we can talk more about that later, but there's a very small subset of Rathke-Clef cysts that are not simple, but they present more often with recurrences or more profound symptoms or atypical types of clinical presentations.
Yes, yeah, indeed. We have also found great difficulty in prescribing a commonality in terms of their hormonal profile, and I would agree with everything you've said. Do you think, in terms of imaging characteristics, that there's, in terms of the overall options and possibilities that you've looked at on imaging, are there any distinctive characteristics that allow us to sort out a priori looking at the imaging, particularly the MRI scan, trying to tease the true Rathke-Clef cyst apart from, say, the patient who had apoplexy, for example, and an old hemorrhage, or one that might have a craniopharyngioma, or one that maybe a cystic adenoma that hadn't really undergone apoplexy but had cystic features. This is always very difficult for the clinician looking at those imaging studies, consulting with the radiologist, and trying to see what the best criteria are that would lead one way or the other before an operation, obviously.
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question when trying to differentiate these various cystic lesions. And I don't think anyone's been able to do that with a formula that has provided any amount of certainty. And the reason is that so many of these things can overlap in their appearance. For instance, the content of Rathke-Clef cysts, whether they're hyperintense on T1 or T2, has not been consistent. Some studies have tried to relate that to the contents because some Rathke-Clef cysts are more liquefied and others have more waxy or solid components. But one paper published that the contents matched up with the degree of T1 or T2 hyperintensity. I have not found that to be the case personally. And as you mentioned, separating these from things like craniopharyngiomas, cystic adenomas, and also always very important to remember in the differential are aneurysms in the cella, which are not extremely common but can never be overlooked or excluded from the differential diagnosis. But the typical Rathke-Clef cysts are usually spherical and are most commonly located in the area of the pars intermedia. So they will usually have a thin enhancing area of gland all the way around in which the anterior gland is pushed forward and posterior gland is pushed backwards. Oftentimes, they'll spread up through the diaphragm into the suprasellar area. Beyond that, it's very, very hard to separate them from other tumors. The other useful thing oftentimes is a CT scan to look for evidence of calcification because, as we know, craniopharyngiomas have a much higher likelihood of being calcified, and that's been very useful. Even things like acute or subacute hemorrhage have not been useful because sometimes Rathke-Clef cysts will also have evidence of microhemorrhage. There's actually a very nice study published last year that described the phenomenon of Rathke-Clef cyst apoplexy.
Mm-hmm.
And so even that is not a slam dunk in terms of separating that from a cystic or hemorrhagic adenoma. And so it is an area where it should be reviewed carefully, oftentimes with the neuroradiology team. And I find that, the clinical presentation and hormonal profile can actually give you a better idea than perhaps the imaging itself.
Are you aware of any pathological imaging correlations that have been done on a subset or maybe even a spectrum of Rathke's cleft cysts where correlations have been made from the pathology, between the pathology post-surgery and the imaging prior to surgery to get at this issue about how imaging relates to pathology?
There have been some, and I think the most important findings to come of those studies have been, again, pertaining to cysts that are recurrent or more aggressive. And, for instance, if you look at a cyst on imaging and it has a very thickened, enhancing wall that seems atypical for a standard Rathke's cleft cyst, which usually has a simple cuboidal or columnar epithelium, the ones with the thickened walls and thickening of the pituitary stalk adjacent to that usually indicate that something else is going on. I think the theory behind that is that sometimes these cysts can spill some of their caustic content into the surrounding gland and stalk and cause a cycle of inflammation. Those cysts that are often associated with things like squamous metaplasia on pathology and stratified epithelium, which are not typical for your normal Rathke's cleft cysts, are usually the ones that are recurrent. They're more associated with things like hypopituitarism or lymphocytic hypophysitis or apoplexy.
Yeah.
And so there is that that subset. So when you see a cyst with a very thickened wall and surrounding edema and hyperintensity of the gland and stalk, I think that should raise your suspicion about something more aggressive going on.
Yes. Another controversy that I think many clinicians have been encountering either in the clinical reports, in the literature, or in clinical practices, this issue of whether or not Rathke's cleft cysts are frequently infected or get infected after surgery or may cause an infection if they spill in a more generalized area in the cisterns. What is your thought about this controversy? How do you tend to weigh in on this in terms of, is it a reality that we need to be aware of? Or is it more anecdotal, if you think?
I think there have been several reports of Rathke's cleft cyst presenting with an infection or superinfection. A cellar abscess, for instance, has been reported to occur with this, or even meningitis or hypophysitis, all those things. There is some overlap between those various entities, and I think that although there is clearly something that is irritative and inflammatory about these cysts when they do spill, causing this, it tends to be the minority. And an actual, for instance, bacterial infection tends to be more anecdotal in my experience. Hmm. And I don't doubt that it's happened, but again, I think that happens to be the minority of cases.
Very well. Now, coming into the domain of surgical strategy, obviously, as you explained, most of these are approached transsphenoidally, and of course today most of those transsphenoidal operations are done endoscopically, and of course are still done microscopically as well, and both approaches are quite appropriate. The question then becomes what one does when one gets in there, and that obviously can include or start with a simple fenestration all the way to drainage or removal of solid contents, if there are solid contents, and or cyst wall, and or drainage, and or other adjuvants, and so forth. Do you think that there have been any categorical theories that clearly weigh in favor or of one strategy over and above another strategy? Obviously, one size doesn't fit all, but do you think that a surgeon approaching these lesions should generally do X, Y, and Z, and then in situations where something else is in the offing, maybe there's this associated CSF leak or it does look infected, then they can modify their strategy. But I'm trying to get at a more generalized strategy for the majority of cases based on your review of the literature as well, what you would counsel as a generalized strategy, and then Then, of course, if things get a little bit more complicated, then one can add several other things into the mix. But what would you advise as a generalized strategy for the usual Rathke's clefts, the uncomplicated ones?
Absolutely. I think there are several nuances looking back through previous publications and my own clinical practice and from the excellent mentors I've been fortunate to have in pituitary surgery. And I think, as you mentioned, it really doesn't matter if you do these microscopically or endoscopically as far as the transfemoral approach. You don't want to limit yourself just because you're considering a simple fenestration. You don't want to limit yourself with the exposure. You still want to have a nice working space because you never know if you're going to have a CSF leak and have to, do a reconstruction or something. So with regard to the approach, I would say don't skimp on the approach. Do the normal amount of exposure, even though it is just a simple fenestration that you're considering. That would be the first thing. With regard to cellar floor exposure, I still expose the entire dura from cavernous sinus to cavernous sinus. And the reason for that is you don't want a minimal hole in the dura. You want a large hole in the dura because you want ongoing cyst drainage even beyond the point of your fenestration. I think some of the most important nuances for this type of surgery are clearly you want to maintain normal pituitary gland function. And so gland preservation is the key to doing this. You want to look at your scans very carefully, identify where the cyst wall is going to be with relationship to not only the anterior gland, but perhaps even more importantly, the posterior gland, because for the uncomplicated cyst, it's located in the pars intermedia, which means that right behind that is where the posterior pituitary gland lives, and that's why these are so intimately associated with diabetes insipidus. Moving forward from there, there have been several studies looking at the idea of a simple cyst wall fenestration or marsupialization versus entire resection of the cyst wall. And I think the general conclusions from looking back at those are that clearly attempting to resect the cyst wall, although it may offer the benefit of a lower recurrence rate, clearly involves a risk of higher diabetes insipidus. And so I think the general consensus in my personal practice is not to attempt complete cyst wall resection to attempt to preserve especially posterior gland function and prevent DI. So I think a general strategy is to identify where the cyst wall is. If possible, taking a biopsy of the cyst wall early is a good idea because once the cyst drains out, it may be hard to biopsy the wall later, and then you may oftentimes be biopsying posterior cyst wall and the posterior gland is at risk. So I like to try to biopsy the wall early, make a very wide fenestration in the cyst wall and not attempt complete capsule removal. And then once you're done with draining the cyst out, the best thing is to not attempt to reconstruct the cellar floor. In the postoperative period, you want to allow the cyst contents to continue drainage for as long as possible. And so I never perform routine cellar floor construction or packing of the cyst once it's done, only for purposes of hemostasis. Now, of course, the caveat to that is cerebrospinal fluid leakage. And, of course, if you have a leak at the end of these cases, a good idea is always to attempt a Valsalva maneuver and try to identify a leak. If you do see a leak, of course, you need to repair it, and you can grade your repair according to, for instance, the Kelly grading system. Fat is always, in my mind, the best option, but the use of abdominal fat grafts has been associated with a higher risk of Rathke cleft cyst recurrence. And that was out of the largest series published by Aho and Weiss et al. From our institution several years ago. So if possible, it's better not to reconstruct the floor, but if you have a leak, of course, you have to do that. And I'd say finally, the last nuance in my mind is that some people have reported using alcohol cauterization to try to attempt to kill the remainder of the cyst wall cells. And out of a very nice paper by Lily High and the Denver group, that was not associated with a lower risk of recurrence and, of course, should never, ever be used if there is evidence of cerebrospinal fluid leakage or an open arachnoid membrane.
Very good. I'm curious as to how a clinician should use the results of the wall biopsy in terms of either tailoring advice to a patient in terms of outcome and recurrence, perhaps maybe in terms of even considering adjuvant therapy if, for example, the wall biopsy tends to favor something more aggressive, such as a craniopharyngioma, because as we alluded to earlier on, that there's a spectrum of histopathology here, and everything from just a regular epithelial wall to more ominous metaplastic wall phenotype. How do you use that data once you have it in terms of stratifying who gets what in terms of follow-up, outcome advice, and perhaps maybe in the most extreme situation, consideration for adjuvant therapy, perhaps?
Yeah, that's also a very good question that I don't think our literature has really borne out yet. But clearly, as we learn more and more about these, those management strategies may become more defined. So clearly, for the simplest Rathke's Cleft Cyst, you just want to watch and wait those with repeat imaging. But as you mentioned, if your biopsy comes back with evidence of something more aggressive, like squamous metaplasia of the cyst wall or stratified epithelium, you know, those things are more concerning for an aggressive lesion and have been associated with recurrence. The normal recurrence rate for a simple Rathke's Cleft Cyst is usually about 10% over a period of 5 years or so, and that's gone up to about 20% in cases with squamous metaplasia or with the use of abdominal fat grafts, as I mentioned earlier. Now, the really aggressive ones, with which we call transitional lesions, and that is, as you mentioned also, are those lesions that fall somewhere in the middle of that spectrum between simpler Rathke's Cleft Cysts and more neoplastic craniopharyngiomas. And it's really a, kind of a conundrum as to what to do with those. I still think that a watch and wait policy in those kind of transitional lesions is the way to go. I think the adjuvant therapy we have, unless patients have really demonstrated that they have several recurrences and you're considering something like a craniopharyngioma, I think radiation still has its risks. And, of course, you know, the risks of hypopituitarism, visual loss, et cetera, associated with it. I would not use it for those transitional lesions at this time. I would actually favor repeat surgery. And for some of those lesions, if you have a patient with that already has hypopituitarism, has had several surgeries, they may even have diabetes insipidus, those are the ones I would say you'd want to treat with more aggressive surgery. You may even consider attempting a whole cyst wall resection if you have to prevent recurrence, even though there is a higher risk of hypopituitarism or DI, which can be replaced subsequently with medical management. But I would shy away from radiation unless you have a documented craniopharyngioma.
Very good. I think we have time enough for one last question, Dr. Zader, and that is, do you have any advice as to what would constitute an absolute indication for craniotomy over, say, a transsphenoidal approach, whether extended transsphenoidal or endoscopic transsphenoidal or microscopic transsphenoidal approach, where you would look at a lesion based on imaging, perhaps, or the history of the lesion, perhaps, or whatever clinical criteria that you might offer as advice for what you would see as an absolute indication for craniotomy?
That's also a fantastic question. I'll first say, just looking at the transsphenoidal surgeries, endoscopic versus microscopic, I use the endoscopic surgery routinely. I think that a lot of the best pituitary surgeons out there still use microscopic techniques. And so it's more about what the surgeon does once they get there with regard to transsphenoidal surgery. Now, with regard to selecting an approach from above versus below, this, as we know, been the topic of much debate and conversation. And in terms of clear criteria, I would say it's the more aggressive lesions. We've gotten so good at even the extended endoscopic and microscopic skull-based approaches. We can now do transplanum, transtuberculum, transclival approaches. We've gotten better at reconstructing the skull base and reducing the risk of postoperative cerebral spinal fluid leakage. So I would say the majority of Rathke's Cleft Cysts can be treated that way. Now, I think the ones that actually warrant a craniotomy are the ones that tend to mimic or behave like craniopharyngiomas that you would consider doing a craniotomy for. So those that tend to be potentially recurrences, localized more to the suprasellar area, or have an intimacy or evidence of adhesion to the optic apparatus or optic nerves or the circle of Willis. And in those cases, one could make the argument that perhaps even a minimally invasive craniotomy like a subfrontal or keyhole approach may be the way to go with regard to things like achieving hemostasis or allowing dissection of the capsule off of these structures. But I would really say that is now the minority of cases. And in rare cases, you'll have retroclival Rathke's cleft cysts that, you know, for instance, have eroded the clivus and are in the area of the posterior fossa. And in those cases, an open approach may be favored as well. But again, it's the minority of cases because we've gotten so good with the endoscopic skull-based approaches.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you very much, Dr. Zader, for your illuminating conversation. And, of course, we appreciate the time you took to help our listeners get to grip with these complex lesions.
It's my pleasure, Dr. Ishiku. Thank you so much. Very much appreciated.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This concludes our podcast for the July issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the August issue when the topic will be craniofacial deformity. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the JNS on Twitter.